Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Then where the photon are we?
Hey. I've sussed it.
What?
This must be Milliways.
Milliways?
Yes, Milliways. The restaurant at the end of the universe.
End of what?
The universe.
When did that end?
In just a few minutes.
Well, how would you write the story of the end of the world? Does it all end with a restaurant meal and a floor show, as the writer Douglas Adams has it? Or do you favor hordes of giant metal insects? Or a zombie invasion from outer space? For a writer with a flair for the dramatic, there's no fun quite like imagining the end of the world, or what comes after. I'm Jim Fleming, and in this hour, a celebration of apocalyptic fiction. Join us as we introduce some writers who've looked into the future and found it missing.
There were only so many ways a person could die. Either your heart took you, or your head took you. Or it was one of the new diseases. The girl who liked to stand beneath the poplar tree in the park said that she had died into an ocean the color of dried cherries. For a while, the water had carried her weight, she said, and she had lain on her back, turning in meaningless circles, singing the choruses of the pop song she remembered. And all around her, she heard that sound, the one that everybody heard, the regular pulsing of a giant heart.
That's an excerpt from Kevin Brockmeyer's Brief History of the Dead. We'll talk with him in a bit. But first, for an overview of recent apocalyptic fiction, we turn to Justin Taylor, editor of an anthology called simply The Apocalypse Reader, a collection of 34 new and selected doomsday scenarios. As the dust jacket says, obliteration never hurt so good. Taylor points out that writers have been making up stories about the end of the world for a long time.
Almost from the beginning of time, people were convinced that they were on the cusp of the end of time. And I think that maybe there's something really fundamental in that fact, something about the sort of absurdity and also, you know, beauty of being here at all. You know, the fact that any of us exist and live is just sort of so phenomenal, and it just immediately occurs to us, you know, in the most general abstract sense, we probably shouldn't be, and maybe soon enough we won't. Those thoughts are sort of conjoined.
Well, and everybody, of course, knows that there is life and there is death, and though it's difficult for any of us to think about our own, we are willing enough, I guess, to think about the end of all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's something comforting about it, right? There's this almost an idea of unity, I think, in this sort of fantasy that you'll be part of the group that witnessed and, you know, not lived through, but, you know, you were there when the world ended, as, you know, not you died and everyone else got to go on, but we all went out together. There's a certain camaraderie in that.
Did you have ideas about what the stories could be about?
Well, I had some notions going in of just what I was looking for. I knew I wanted classic material like Edgar Allan Poe, Hawthorne. So I wanted the book to have, you know, that sense of scope across time. And I also wanted to include a lot of real contemporary stuff. Shelley Jackson, Dennis Cooper, who's one of my favorite writers.
There's a story called Gigantic. Introduce it for us, will you?
So Steve Aylett is a British writer, sort of new wave, contemporary sci-fi. That may be a reductive description, but it's kind of the best I can come up with off the cuff. He's very hard to pin down. His work really transcends just about any genre. So in this story, which is called Gigantic, is a story from Steve's collection called Toxicology. In this story, a guy named Professor Skychum, basically he's discovered this secret about the universe, which is that there's this problem with guilt, that it's accreting sort of in the interstices of the time-space continuum. And all human guilt from basically every you know, bad thing that humans have ever done to each other, is creating this physical stuff. And Skychum has basically realized that it's reaching a critical mass.
Over the White House, a screeching noise erupted. The central eye of a multidimensional airship was opening. Striations like silver insect wings cracked, massive steel doors grinding downward. For the space of two heartbeats, everything stopped. Then a tiny tear dropped out of the eye, splashing on the White House roof, and then another, falling like a light fleck of snow. These were corpses, these two, human corpses, followed by more in a shower which grew heavier by the moment, some crashing now through the roof, some rolling to land in the drive, bouncing to hit the lawn, bursting to paint the porticos. And then the eye began gushing. 68 forgotten pensioners buried in a mass grave in 1995 were dumped over the Chicago social services. Hundreds of blacks murdered in police cells hit the roof of Scotland Yard. Thousands of slaughtered East Timorese were dumped over the assembly buildings in Jakarta. Berlin was almost instantly clotted, its streets packed wall to wall with victims. Beijing was swamped with tank fodder and girl babies. No longer preserved by denial, they started to sludge. Carpet-bombing gore splattered the suburbs, followed by human slurry tumbling down the streets like lava. Cheap human fallout from pain ignored and war extended for profit. The first wave. So far, only 60 years worth. Skychum had taken the 820 Amtrak north from Grand Central. It had a policy of not stopping for bodies. Grim, he viewed the reigning horizon, and presently, quietly, he spoke. Many happy returns.
That's an image that's not likely to leave soon. But there's more. There's humor in the way that he tells that story, and it's part of what makes it sell, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how many of the writers seem to look at the apocalypse, I guess, as a way to tell us who we are and where we are and what we're doing. I was thinking back about Nathaniel Hawthorne. I can't remember the name of the story that he wrote that you included.
It's called Earth's Holocaust.
Well, tell me about it.
It's sort of a fable. And what Earth's Holocaust is about is this figure, very much like Hawthorne himself, is watching this movement and these people, as he says, the wide world had become so overburdened with an accumulation of worn-out trumpery that the inhabitants determined to rid themselves of it by a general bonfire. So people are just – they're tired of their stuff and the old ways in the world. And so they build this bonfire and they start throwing things into it, you know, just old junk that they don't need anymore. And then the bonfire gets a little bit bigger and then they decide that they're going to get rid of – coats of arms. We don't need these anymore. You know, this is the old way and all men are better than this and so on. So they start burning coats of arms, tobacco, marriage licenses, money, tax documents. The bonfire keeps getting bigger and they keep getting more aggressive.
"See what heaps of books and pamphlets," cried a fellow who did not seem to be a lover of literature. "Now we shall have a glorious blaze." "That's just the thing," said a modern philosopher. "Now we shall get rid of the weight of dead man's thought, which has hitherto pressed so heavily on the living intellect. Well done, my lads. Into the fire with them. Now you are enlightening the world indeed." "But what is to become of the trade?" cried a frantic bookseller. "Oh, by all means, let them accompany their merchandise," coolly observed an author. "It will be a noble funeral pile." In fact, the last remnant of the literature of all the ages was now descending upon the blazing heap, leaving the earth, for the first time since the days of Cadmus, free from the plague of letters. An enviable field for the authors of the next generation.
I think it's fascinating to look back at a century ago or more and see that people are concerned about some of the same things that we are.
Yes, absolutely.
There are some of the authors who have had some fun. Neil Gaiman, for instance, he has a story, I think it's called When We Went to See the End of the World. It's told by an 11-year-old girl. right?
Yeah, that story is a riot. Neil posits that the end of the world is, it's a place for him, almost like a cheesy amusement park. So it's narrated by Donnie Morningside, age 11 and a quarter, whose parents are taking the whole family on this trip to go spend the day at the end of the world and have a picnic there.
This is what it looks like at the end of the world, which is the best place in the world. There is a hole in the ground, which looks like a very wide, big hole, and pretty people holding sticks and scimitars that burn come up out of it. They have long golden hair. They look like princesses, only fierce. Some of them have wings and some of them doesn't. And there's a big hole in the sky, too, and things are coming down from it, like the cat-heady man, and the snake's made out of stuff that looks like glitter gel, like I put it on my hair at Hallowmorn, and I saw something that looked like a big gold buzzy fly coming down from the sky. There were very many of them, as many as stars. They don't move. They just hang there, not doing anything. I asked Daddy why they weren't moving, and he said that they were moving, just very slowly, but I don't think so. We set up at a picnic table. What's after the end of the world? I said to my dad. Nothing, he said. Nothing at all. That's why it's called the end. Then Daisy was sick over Daddy's shoes, and we cleaned it up.
It's funny, isn't it, to think of them taking a day trip to see the end of the world. There are so many themes that sort of come back. Different people treat them different ways. There is a story called These Zombies Are Not a Metaphor, which anybody who has read Richard Matheson's book or, I suppose, seen the movie, I Am Legend, would understand.
Well, the premise of Jeff's story is that there's this full-scale zombie outbreak, you know, in this sort of classic George Romero sense, and the narrator and his small group of friends are barricaded in their house trying to stage their last stand. But all the narrator's friends are so preoccupied with the zombie as metaphor to the point where they can't recognize the physical, you know, absolutely non-metaphoric zombie that's physically trying to break the door down.
When the full-scale zombie outbreak finally occurred, I was the only one prepared. I don't mean with supplies and weapons and secure shelter, but more importantly, I had the proper mental fortification. Baxter said to me, "These zombies are a metaphorical scourge upon the earth. They represent all that is evil in humankind." Then he went outside, got bitten, and turned into one of them. I held a meeting with the rest of my housemates. "Let's be very clear," I said. "These zombies are not a metaphorical scourge upon the earth. These zombies are an actual scourge upon the earth." I pointed out the window. We could see the hordes of walking dead in the streets, tearing into the flesh of the living. These zombies do not represent all that is evil in humankind. They do not represent anything except zombies. "Yes, yes," Manny and Janine nodded at me, blank affirmative stares, eager for leadership in the uncertainty of the world's end. A half-decayed, blood-smeared face smashed itself up against my metal-barred, bulletproof glass window. I flipped a switch and activated the electric current. "Not an allegory, an analogy, or an illusion," I said. "This is not the foreshadowing of the downfall of man. This is the downfall itself."
Wow. Each of these stories, when you get to the end, gives you that same frisson, doesn't it, of wondering when the end is going to come in your world. What is it that is so attractive about the apocalypse to writers?
Well, I think, you know, that in a certain sense that, you know, all writing, all attempts to create a narrative, they're attempts at mastery, really. You know, you're trying to establish yourself as a speaking voice and, you know, assert some sort of control over a situation, you know, real or imagined. Even just, you know, stake out a little space of your own, you know, in the world. And so the apocalypse, you know, it's this giant signal moment and it has such gravity. And you can really project almost anything you want onto it or fantasize anything you like about it. And that just makes it so ripe. But I think, as you know, as a writer, as an artist, in that sort of Beckettian sense of failing better, you know that's sort of the biggest way you can bomb out because it's just, it's beyond everybody. So of course it's beyond you. But at the same time, that makes you want to go, you know, write for it.
Justin Taylor is the editor of The Apocalypse Reader, a collection of 34 short stories about
The End of the World. Our selections were read by Peter Sobel, Ariella Borod, Norman Gilliland, and Doug Gordon. And you can hear the rest of Jeff Goldberg's zombie story on our website at ttbook.org. On our staff, it's getting hard to find someone who hasn't read and loved Kevin Brockmeyer's novel The Brief History of the Dead. Brockmeyer is a young writer often listed as someone to watch. His stories have appeared in The New Yorker, McSweeney's, and The Best American Short Stories. His novel, The Brief History of the Dead, is a surprisingly lyrical story, considering that all of the characters except one are dead. At the center of the story is a place called The City, which is where all the dead characters live. And Strange Chimps sat down with Kevin Brockmeyer recently and asked him to read from the book.
The Brief History of the Dead, Chapter 1, The City. When the blind man arrived in the city, he claimed that he had traveled across a desert of living sand. First he had died, he said, and then, snap, the desert. He said that the desert was bare and lonesome, and that it had hissed at him like a snake. He had walked for days and days, until the dunes broke apart beneath his feet, surging up around him to lash at his face. Then everything went still and began to beat like a heart. It was only at that moment, he said, with a million arrow points of sand striking his skin, that he truly realized he was dead. The stories people told about the crossing were as varied and elaborate as their 10 billion lives. Lev Paley said that he had watched his atoms break apart like marbles, roll across the universe, then gather themselves together again out of nothing at all. Hanbing Li said that he woke inside the body of an aphid and lived an entire life in the flesh of a single peach. Graciela Cavazos would say only that she began to snow, four words, and smile bashfully whenever anyone pressed her for details.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
So this is where your book begins, in a world, a community, I guess, of people who are dead?
Yes. Yes, the dead but not yet forgotten. We discover by the end of the first chapter that that's who they are.
What made you want to write about life after death?
Well, I think it's, you know, one of the biggest questions we're faced with, one of the biggest mysteries we're faced with as human beings, kind of the conglomerate mystery. Who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? And it seems to me like a fertile ground for a piece of fiction.
The city, your world of the dead, is so richly imagined. How did you come to kind of put it together? Did you have any particular inspiration?
The notion came from a piece of African folklore that I ran across in a book of nonfiction by James Lewin called Lies My Teacher Told Me. Mm. And he mentions very briefly toward the end of the book this notion in African folklore of three terrains of existence: the living, which is a terrain we all understand; the dead, who have not yet passed out of living memory, which are called the Sasha in this realm of folklore; and then the dead who have passed out of living memory, who are the Zamani. And the dead who have passed out of living memory might not be entirely forgotten, but again, there's nobody around who specifically remembers encountering those people. And this was a notion that intrigued me. And the more I thought about it, the more interested I became in this kind of between stage, the Sasha, the dead but not yet forgotten. Occasionally, one of the dead, someone who had just completed the crossing, would mistake the city for heaven. It was a misunderstanding that never persisted for long. What kind of heaven had the blasting sound of garbage trucks in the morning, and chewing gum on the pavement, and the smell of fish rotting by the river? What kind of hell, for that matter, had bakeries and dogwood trees and perfect blue days that made the hairs on the back of your neck rise on end? No, the city was not heaven, and it was not hell, and it certainly was not the world. It stood to reason, then, that it had to be something else.
Now, when this book opens, the City of the Dead has a problem. More and more people are dying, so the city is filling up.
Yes.
But just as rapidly, it seems to be emptying out.
Yes.
What's happening?
Well, you know, again, the notion behind the book is that you remain in the city only so long as you last in living memory. So as people continue to die, they appear in the city. But as the people who remember them also die, they vanish from the city. And by the end of the first chapter, it becomes plain that a calamity of some kind has befallen the world of the living. And so more and more people have appeared and then vanished very, very swiftly from the city.
And in fact, what's happened is this enormous pandemic, a plague,
yes,
has swept the world, the kind of virus maybe we're all terrified of, you know,
yes,
when you read headlines in the papers. What are some of your, this is an odd question, but what are some of your favorite parts about the human race dying off?
Well, I guess the things that would come to my mind are just tiny moments that appear here and there in the text. One of them is there's a woman to whom we're introduced in the second chapter, Laura Bird, who's been isolated in the Antarctic and doesn't quite know what's happened. And she slowly begins to discover that this virus has befallen the human race. And at one point, she picks up a radio signal from a man who's broadcasting in another language. And he's just repeating a message on a loop, just speaking to anybody who could possibly hear him about what's happened, and also saying goodbye to his wife in case she's out there listening somewhere. I remember that. And then I remember
that passage. And the thing he keeps repeating is something like, do not come to the city. There are no survivors.
Yeah.
Repeat, there are no survivors.
Yeah.
And just
yeah,
the sound of this one lone voice, that's all that's left. It's a really grim, terrifying moment.
Yes, yes. And then another thing, a small detail that for some reason is lodged in my head, is this notion of a planet depleted of all human life that is continuing to be circled by the satellites that we shot up into the atmosphere. And there's just one sentence that mentions that very briefly in passing. But something about the image is one that seems powerful to me somehow.
Yes. You know, your book falls into the sort of rubric of a kind of literature people call post-apocalyptic fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I really like so much about yours is it's not a horribly morbid book. In fact, there's such, I think part of it is because you treat most of your characters with great tenderness and great affection. But I wonder, was that a deliberate choice? I mean, did you think about how your book might fit into this field of post-apocalyptic fiction?
Well, I have enjoyed reading a number of pieces of post-apocalyptic fiction. Specifically, I would mention the work of J.G. Ballard. And his early short stories in particular were post-apocalyptic tales that are just marvelously constructed and crystalline in their language and so beautiful. But Ballard, in particular, is a writer who has a reputation for being a great prose craftsman who's really not all that interested in human beings. I suppose most of the fiction of this type that I've read myself, even if I love it, it is fiction that has kind of a grim attitude toward the human race and doesn't think very highly of us and what
we're
capable
of. So we might as well be wiped out.
Yeah, yeah, that seems to be the attitude. And again, there are a lot of these books that I admire, but it's just not my attitude. You know, I mean, I wanted to tell a story, a post-apocalyptic story that was loving toward its characters.
One of the other things that I really like about this book is the fact that in many cases, people's lives have improved by dying.
Yeah.
So Laura's parents, who have died in this plague, wind up falling in love all over again,
yes,
after they're dead. There's a wonderful kind of heart-filled passage in which you describe that. I wondered if you'd read that for us.
Sure. Dying had changed Marion Bird. She had been so weary back when she was alive. Weary of talking and weary of eating. Weary of thinking, remembering, desiring, anticipating. Weary, most of all, of the prospect of seeing her life out to its natural end. But then the virus had appeared and she had died. And suddenly everything was different. She began to appreciate all the things she thought she had forgotten how to enjoy, like music and dancing, and the way the breeze felt on her neck when she pinned her hair up and back. And then there was the matter of her husband. It seemed only natural, with all the other changes she had undergone, that she would love him again. She listened to him swishing his razor around in the sink, for instance, and then tapping it clean against the porcelain, tap, tap, tap. And she knew that he would clear his throat next, and then dry his face, and only after he had blown his nose into a tissue and carefully straightened the towel on the rack would he call out to her with some question or other. The whole unwavering performance used to fill her with despair, but these days she found herself charmed by it.
Why do you think we like imagining the end of the world, or thinking about it? Because this certainly isn't a subject that only fiction writers take on. I mean, people think a great deal about the end of the world in lots of different ways.
Yes, they do. I mean, almost every religious tradition has got its own tale of what the end will be like. You know, it may come back to that mystery I mentioned, just our lack of knowledge about what we're doing here and, you know, how strange it is simply to be here at all. You know, what will become of us when the whole thing comes to an end?
Beyond the awareness of the mystery and the curiosity, though, I think there's some actual pleasure we take in imagining the end and really sort of sketching it out the way you've done. I wonder where the pleasure comes in.
Well, I mean, it certainly cleans things up a lot, you know, to know where things are going, doesn't it? And aside from that, I mean, we're storytelling creatures. Most of us are, at least, and we take great pleasure in stories. And if you've got a story, you want to know the beginning and the middle and the end. And, you know, we're all immersed in the middle, so we know a lot about that. And we have a lot of speculation about the beginning and a lot of speculation about the end, but we have no direct experience of it. And so I think telling stories about the beginning and the end might simply satisfy that storytelling impulse in us.
Kevin Brockmeyer talking with Anne Strangechamps. His novel is called The Brief History of the Dead. Still to come, one of the country's best-selling writers is a guy you may never have heard of, but I bet your teenager has. We'll meet Scott Westerfeld, creator of today's hippest teen science fiction, late at this hour. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. There actually is an apocalypse already happening in our world, one that most of us barely notice. The animals are dying. This underreported fact lies at the heart of novelist Lydia Millett's new book, How the Dead Dream. Here's an excerpt. Say an individual was the very last of its kind. Say it was small, one of the kangaroo rats, for instance, and ran from a young fox through a hardscrabble field, towering clouds casting long shadows over the grass. The run lasted a few seconds only. No one was watching, no one at all, because there was no one for miles around, no one but insects and worms and a jet passing high overhead. Say, neither of them knew either, the fox or the rat, that the rat was the last, that no rat like him would ever be born again. Was it different then? Did the world feel the loss? Others were sure to fall afterward. A long fly with iridescent wings that lived only in the nest of this single rat, say. A parasite that lived under the wing of the fly. A flowering plant whose roots were nourished by the larval phase of the parasite. A bat that pollinated the plant. It was time that would show the loss. Only time that would show how the world had been stripped of its mysteries, stripped by the hundreds and thousands and millions. Remaining would be only the pigeons and the raccoons. It sounds like nonfiction, but How the Dead Dream is also a story of a young real estate developer whose life falls apart and who becomes obsessed by endangered animals. Millett told Steve Paulson that where she lives, she's acutely aware of how often we humans contribute to the death of wildlife, even unintentionally.
I live in the middle of a national park outside Tucson in the desert, and too many times I've hit an animal, even though I try to creep through the park as slowly as I can in my car. But I've hit various animals. I hit a ringtail once. That was the worst, one of the worst moments, really, of my life.
A ringtail deer?
No, a ringtail is a sort of, in the raccoon family, very beautiful animal. It's, I wouldn't say it's rare, but it's, you don't see them as often as coyotes by any means, and they're nocturnal. And I hit one once. I just sort of watched it drag its body off the road. It dragged the insides of its body sort of after it off the road. And it was just one of the most painful things that has ever happened to me, actually.
It's interesting to hear that response. I mean, I think most people would certainly be saddened by an experience like that, hitting an animal on the road, but, you know, probably get past it not too much longer after that. You know, it certainly wasn't intentional, but it sounds like it's more than that to you.
Well, you do get past it. It's just one of those things that you can't stop your life for, or that is, we don't stop our lives for that kind of death. And that's partly what I write about in this novel, is that we don't stop our lives for much of anything like that. But I am actually particularly affected by people who hit animals on purpose. I've actually observed in my neighborhood people running over animals they don't like on purpose, swerving their trucks, say, to go over a rattlesnake. And that's particularly painful to me to see.
Now, in your novel, T, your main character, is a very successful real estate developer. He's made a lot of money young. I mean, he's still in his 20s. And then he finally falls in love, but his girlfriend dies in a tragic accident. And I mean, just as it seemed like he was getting his life together. And then he becomes obsessed with animals, with rare animals in particular. Am I right to read this as almost this becomes compensation for his personal loss?
You are right. And I think also he finds something to identify with in the condition of animals that are about to go extinct, because they're so isolated, and he feels extraordinarily isolated and alone.
It's almost like a conversion experience. I mean, he suddenly discovers the glories of nature, which makes me wonder if you've had any experience like this.
You know, I have in a way, although I can't say that my particular sort of epiphany happened in a moment, but I was just a very urban person growing. I grew up in a big city, and I always lived in big cities. And it was only when I came to the desert, well, it was really in 1990 originally, I came out to Arizona. And it was the first time I really knew nature at all. And I was overwhelmed by it. The sun sets out here, the skies being so vast. I did find that I had to leave cities eventually in my life, that, you know, I lived in Toronto, I lived in LA, I lived in New York. I finally had to leave them because I didn't find anything sublime in day-to-day life in the city, because I just didn't get to see beyond people ever and the things that we have made. And I need to be away from the things that we've made really every day to be happy in my life. That was what I discovered when I came to the country after being a city girl for so long.
So you found solace in nature?
You know, I just found something that wasn't myself, that didn't remind me of myself. And actually, it's not that I mind myself particularly. It's just that I like to be reassured that there's a beautiful universe out there that has nothing to do with me and my people and the mistakes that we all make.
So it's not just getting outside yourself, it's getting outside of human beings, period.
Yeah, it is, it is.
Now, there's another piece of your story, and that's T becomes obsessed with zoos. He wants to be near wild and rare animals, and he starts breaking into zoos at night and going into the enclosures just to be near the animals. Are there people who actually do this, or was this strictly a fictional device?
Oh, you know, there actually are quite a few people who do this. They're sort of zoophiles, I suppose, who specifically break into zoos to be near the animals. It actually does exist as almost a subculture. I don't know, you know, what the numbers are, but people who work in zoos will tell you that this is a not infrequent occurrence, that someone has just wanted to be close to an animal. And it doesn't have to be a big charismatic animal. It could be a bird. It could be a lizard. You know, people really try to get into these enclosures with startling regularity. He went back that night when the zoo was closed, thrilled as if he was lightly drunk at the illicitness in himself. It was new. What arrested him in the zoo was the wildness it contained, how far this was from the realm of his competence. He wanted to meet it, He knew the zoo animals lived in cages, but nothing more about them except that they were alone, most of them. Not only alone in the cages often, but alone on the earth, vanishing. Their condition was close to what he was trying to grasp, lay somehow at the base of his growing suspicion that the ground was no longer fixed, was shifting beneath him. Empire only looked good built against a backdrop of oceans and forests. It needed them. If the oceans were dead and the forests replaced by pavement, even empire would be robbed of its consequence. Alone, he thought, a word that came to him more and more, in sing-song, like a jeer. In the zoo, the rare animals might have been orphaned or captured or even born in captivity. He had no idea where they came from, could not know their individual histories, but he knew their position as he knew his own. They were at the forefront of aloneness, like pioneers. They were the ones sent ahead to see what the new world was like. Would they tell what they saw?
Do you see what's happening to the animal world right now as a kind of apocalypse as more and more species go extinct every year?
I do. I do see it as apocalyptic. You know, species are, animals and plants are disappearing about 100 to 1,000 times faster every year than is sort of natural in recent history. And in about 70% of scientists, of biologists, refer to this time of ours as, the sixth great extinction wave, the previous fifth wave having been 65 million years ago with the dinosaurs disappearing. So, I think in scientific terms, it simply is apocalyptic. Also, the problem of global warming threatens to drive about a third of the creatures in the world extinct by the end of this century is the projection. So, and that's just global warming alone driving those extinctions. So, yeah, I think we're seeing something on an apocalyptic scale.
What do you hope your readers will take away from this book?
Oh, that's a complex question. I want them to question. I want them to, I want them to feel, partly I want them to have an experience of empathy for these creatures that are on the edge of oblivion and for the people who will be affected by the loss of these animals, our children, their children. I think I want people to also feel that perhaps that they have a connection to this, that this is not something sort of just academic happening outside them or something that only has to do with politics and leadership. I mean, I think it has to do with everyone feeling the role that animals play in their lives, their language, their metaphor, their system of aesthetics. I mean, animals are a lot more to us than I think we consciously recognize in our daily lives. And so this book wants to touch that a bit.
I have to say, you have one of the most unusual acknowledgement pages that I've ever read in a novel. and I think this would be a great way to end this conversation. Your last paragraph, in a sense, it's the dedication of the book. It's the long list of rare animals that are disappearing.
And of course, this is just a tiny, tiny sampling of them. But I'd be happy to read it if you would like.
Yes, I would.
To the memory of the West African black rhinoceros, which disappeared from the world in the time it took to write this book, and in honor of the rarest species in the United States, any of which may vanish in the blink of an eye, the Alabama beach mouse, Alabama lamp mussel, Alabama sturgeon, Atwater's greater prairie chicken, Berkeley kangaroo rat, Buena Vista Lake ornate shrew, Cahaba pebble snail, Carolina elk toe, cat's paw, devil's hole pupfish, Florida panther, Florida salt marsh vole, Hosberg's love grass, Franciscan manzanita, giant Palouse earthworm, Guam Micronesian kingfisher, Hawaiian crow, Hawaiian monk seal, interrupted rock snail, Key Largo wood rat, Lang's metalmark butterfly, and Miami blue butterfly.
Lydia Millett's new novel, How the Dead Dream, was listed by the National Book Critics Circle as one of the 10 best of the year. Steve Paulson spoke with her. Next, a post-apocalypse world in which everyone is radiantly beautiful because the government performs cosmetic surgery on all the teenagers. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. One of the best-known young adult writers in the country has made a name for himself writing post-apocalyptic and dystopian science fiction for teenagers. His name is Scott Westerfeld. Teens know him as the author of the Peeps series, about a bunch of parasite-positive vampires, and of the best-selling novels Uglies and Pretties, about a future world in which cosmetic surgery is compulsory. And Strange Champs asked Westerfeld where that gruesome idea came from.
A friend of mine moved to Los Angeles about 6 years ago, and he went to the dentist and had what he thought was a fairly normal appointment. But then afterwards, she asked him to come back to her office and put these questions to him that were very strange. One of them was, you know, where do you want your teeth to be in 5 years? And he was sort of nonplussed by this. And what he finally realized is that she was saying, look, you know, here's your regular New Yorker teeth, and over here is Tom Cruise. How far do you want to go over the next 5 years? How much money do you want to spend? How much time do you want to spend in my chair? How much pain do you want to endure to have a 5-year plan for your teeth?
And I suppose the frightening thing was that to her these seemed like normal questions?
Yeah, this was what you do at the dentist in Los Angeles, or at least at that dentist in Los Angeles. And, you know, he started walking around L.A. trying to figure out who had the 5-year plan and seeing these seeing these teeth and realizing that some of these people were, in fact, you know, on their way to Tom Cruise mouthdom. And I started thinking, wow, what would it be like if when you went to the doctor, it wasn't about health or exercise or diet, but it was about the way you look, like when you go to the hairdresser. And I started to just get the idea of projecting this trend 300 years into the future and having a society where plastic surgery was not only, you know, ubiquitous and cheap, but also mandatory.
Well, describe a bit of that, because in your first two books in this series, Uglies and Pretties, cosmetic surgery has become, well, this bizarre coming-of-age, right? A mandatory coming-of-age, right? Will you describe this world some?
Sure. Basically, in the Uglies world, the way you look is written into the language itself. And once you turn 16, you get this plastic surgery that completely changes your facial structure and even your height. Gives you a new layer of skin, makes you look sort of racially average, so you look a little bit Asian, a little bit African, a little bit European. So it turns you into this, what they call a pretty. So everyone who's over 16 is called a pretty. And in that uncomfortable age, between sort of 10 or 11 and 16, when you get the operation, you are called an ugly. So the you know, the uglies are basically told that they're ugly. They make fun of each other for the way they look. You're just you're brainwashed into thinking that you're ugly and you need this operation to become a real person or a pretty.
That's actually sort of not a bad critique of our current world in which, you know, attractiveness does get privileged.
Yeah, I was reading a lot of research as I was beginning to write this about how kids who are deemed more attractive tend to get better grades and they're treated better by their peers. Adults who are more attractive tend to make more money. That people actually treat you better if you're more attractive. So this society's idea is that if everyone's attractive, this will be a more well-balanced, more just society where everyone treats each other fairly.
When the first of these books, Uglies, came out, it became an instant hot read among teenagers. I mean, the book spread by word of mouth, and by the time your latest in this series, Extras, came out, you know, it debuted at number 2 on the bestseller list. Why do you think these books have spoken so powerfully to teenagers? What do they tell you about them?
Well, I'm surprised at how many, particularly girls, have written me and said, you know, I was going to get plastic surgery. I was going to get a nose job when I turned 17 or 18. And after reading Uglies, I decided not to. You know, and that's actually, it's a pretty intense kind of email to get. I always joke, if I can save just one nose, it's all been worth it. But I think, you know, there are these incredible pressures on teenagers, particularly girls, but more and more so on boys as well, to feel like they have to reach these perfect physical archetypes.
Are boys starting to get cosmetic surgery?
What boys do instead of plastic surgery is they take steroids.
Mm.
You know, it's the same kind of self-mutilation for cosmetic purposes, but it's a different kind of thing. It's not so much surgery as drugging yourself.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was thinking that this kind of issue that you're dealing with, physical attractiveness, certainly speaks really powerfully to adults. So you could easily have chosen to write a novel for adults about these issues. You chose to write the novels for a young adult audience. I was wondering why, but it sounds like from what you say, maybe these issues hit teenagers even more powerfully than they do adults.
Well, adults kid themselves that attractiveness is not an important part of their life. But when you're a teenager, there's a joke in science fiction that the golden age of science fiction is 14. And the reason why is because when you're 14 years old, you're still willing to question the rules of the world. And the rule of the pretties, you know, the rule that beautiful people are listened to more and that we buy into all this stuff, those rules seem more random and more ridiculous to you when you're 13 than they do when you're an adult and you've sort of bought into everything.
And I suppose when you go to junior high and high school also, you're living in a world in which there's a great deal more social control than there is for adults. And so in some ways I can see why reading dystopian novels would fit for teenagers. You know, it's not that far off from the world they already live in.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a bell rings and you are told where to go. Your haircut is monitored. The clothes you wear are monitored. You know, you have to select the schedule of your day from a sort of menu or have someone else select it for you and then get it approved by your parents. I mean, it is a dystopian novel, basically.
Do teenagers say that to you?
Well, they don't use the word dystopia often, but they do sort of inherently understand the need to be free as a sort of constant battle. Like, you don't get freedom when you're a teenager. It's not handed to you. It's something you sort of gouge out and invent, and you find the spaces where you can go, where you can be free. One of the reasons why I referred to that age group as uglies, you know, sort of 11 to 15, mm-hmm. is because whatever people that age do tends to be criminalized. Like, in my day, it was skateboards. We all got skateboards when I was about 12. And a month later, the no skateboarding signs were everywhere. And my wife and I were in Britain in October, and there were all these signs in restaurants saying, you know, we do not serve customers with black hoodies. And obviously, you know, file sharing, MySpace, anything that teenagers do en masse has to be the subject of a Senate inquiry.
Well, tell me about your newest book in this series, Extras. You've introduced a slightly different world. In this one, people are obsessed less with physical attractiveness and now with fame and popularity. Where did your ideas for this world come from?
There was a one book, one school project that was done in Indiana, a small rural town in Indiana. And they basically bought 600 copies of Uglies and gave them to every kid, every teacher, every, you know, PTA volunteer, administrator, janitor. Everyone in school got them. And they all read it. And I went down, and I was really amazed at how, you know, how intense it was to be in a place where everybody had read my book. And this one kid raised his hand during a question and answer session and absolutely seriously said, you know, "Mr. Westerfeld, do you know Paris Hilton?" And I was really, you know, it was one of those very strange, where do you want your mouth to be in 5 years kind of questions. And later I was talking to the teachers and asking what it was he was asking me. And I realized that he had maybe in this, you know, small town in rural Indiana, he had never seen, you know, anybody treated like a rock star who'd just written a book. And he was trying to figure out, do you hang out with Paris Hilton? Do you hang out with Kobe Bryant or the president? Like, how famous are you? And the other aspect of this was, the other inspiration was, I write with a number of authors, and invariably somebody mentions their Amazon ranking and, you know, realizes, oh, my book just went up 6,000 on Amazon. So we're getting all this information back about how famous we are. Like, how many MySpace friends do I have? How many people have watched the YouTube video I uploaded yesterday? The weird place that I create in Extras is a city in which everyone's constantly monitored. And every time you talk about someone or hum a tune that they wrote or dress like them, you know, you increase their face rank. You make them a little bit more famous. And if you go hide in your apartment for a couple months and no one talks about you, then you get less famous.
And so everybody's trying to become more famous?
Well, what happens is there's a character whose name is Aya, and her older brother has just hit the top 1,000. So he's really famous. He's sort of he's what they call a kicker, which is sort of a blogger who makes other people famous, and that's how he's become famous. And she is way off into extra land. She's like 400,000th most famous person in this city of a million. And she's trying to become famous. And what she discovers is that there's this group called the Sly Girls who are doing these incredibly cool tricks that would make them famous, that would make them terrifically popular, except they're not taking advantage of it. They're doing them anonymously, and they're hiding, and they're trying to keep – in fact, their face ranks are at the very bottom of the millionth. That's how they determine status in their little micro community, is who has the lowest face rank is the leader.
You know, the scary thing about reading your novels is that you can so easily see all this happening. I mean, even the futuristic technology you've created, you know, doesn't actually seem that far-fetched. Do you think we're actually going to go more and more in that direction?
Yeah, I don't think we have a choice. I mean, a certain kind of privacy is dying, and there's no way to get it back. But, you know, certain kinds of privacy have always disappeared. It used to be able to go off and live in the woods and nobody would even know where you were, ever. That kind of thing is impossible now, or well-nigh impossible for most people.
You know, it seems to me that there are even deeper issues here than fame or physical attractiveness. It seems to me that what's at the heart of all of the books that you write is you're wrestling with the questions about how much we can control and this human desire we have to choose our lives, to choose to be whatever we can be.
Well, I mean, what it is to be human has changed so rapidly over the last, you know, 100 years. Once you invent the telephone, it becomes radically different just to be a human being, because you go from somebody who can talk only to people in the room you're in to people who can talk to someone all over the world. You think of that as just a technology or a trick, but it really makes you magic compared to previous generations. And the fact that we're all living in what are basically magical times doesn't always sink in, and we don't always realize it. So that's why I think science fiction, I mean, a lot of the kids who write me, a lot of the girls who write me in particular say, you know, I never read science fiction, but I loved Uglies. I loved these books. And it's because the science fiction I'm writing is about their lives. It's not about rocket ships or, you know, the sort of space age technologies. It's about, in effect, cell phones and the small technologies that you hold in your hand, keep in your purse, put in your pocket, that have really changed the way we live in a way that rocket ships never did.
Scott Westerfeld has written a dozen or so young adult novels. He talked with Ann Strainchamps about the series that includes Uglies, Pretties, and most recently, Extras. Oh, and by the way, the music we're listening to is also by Scott Westerfeld. We found it on his blog. You can too. For links and more information about anything you heard in this hour, visit our website. You can also listen to all of our shows there, and you'll find a link to our podcast. It's all at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. If you'd like to purchase a copy of this hour, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Apocalyptic Fiction Show, number 120A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Ann Strainchamps, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickard. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. We always like to know what you think of our programs. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We look forward to hearing from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.